The Burt Cohen Show, Thursdays at 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
It's the Burt Cohen Show. The dream is different from all different perspectives. It depends how you experience it. Burt Cohen here. We're going to be talking today about the original inhabitants of this land, the people who have gotten unbelievably shafted through the years, just a remarkably successful genocide, believe it or not. But it's not over yet, not by a long shot. There's a lot of hope for the Native Americans, the First Nation people, that not only for them, but possibly for the rest of the world as well. There may be examples that we can follow. Our guest today on the Burt Cohen Show is Elsa Johnson, is it, I believe?
Yes.
Elsa Johnson, yes, director of the INA Solutions, that's I-I-N-A, which is a humanitarian and environmental justice organization she established to help improve the quality and life for rural Navajo elders who lack basic human needs and to bring commerce to Navajo land via clean energy. Well, thanks again for being with us, Elsa Johnson. And most of us thought that the federal government stopped taking land from Indians and giving it to powerful private hands a hundred years ago anyway. But that's not necessarily the case now, is it? What has been going on? Tell us a little bit about the history of something called Big Mountain and why understanding what's been going on there may be important to the future of all of us.
Well, I think America doesn't realize that approximately 60% of all America's natural resources sit on the Indian lands, and there's such a dependence on coal and uranium, those types of power, and we're seeing that firsthand on Navajo Nation. And my ancestral land is just a few miles from the world's largest strip mining operation by Peabody Coal. And so we live the effects of all of these mining, and we are also feeling them health in our, daily lives, and also as far as the environment. We're seeing such drastic impacts on the environment, our water sources. And so that's I think all of America in the tribes are experiencing. And I just want to share this quote from a tribal chairman of the Moapaw Band of Paiutes over in Nevada. I think this is so, appropriate. He says, air quality and public health hazards should not depend on political winds driven by those who never have to inhale the pollution they authorize.
Wow.
And basically, we're feeling the brunt of all of the, what America is really enjoying. We're the ones that are, first in line to feel the health impacts, the environmental impacts. And so that's what's happening in America right now.
Well, most people, they want to turn on their stereo or their flat screen TV. They flick a switch. End of story. Don't think about it. But tell us about what I guess there's been a great deal of coal. You said something like 60% of all mined resources come from Native American lands?
Yes.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Well, what has gone on with that specifically with regard to coal and with regard to uranium?
Let me just talk about Navajo Nation because that's where I'm from. Our reservation is 27,000 square miles in northeastern Arizona, northwestern New Mexico, and the southern tip of Utah. And it's the size of West Virginia and is larger than 10 of the 50 American states. And the with an altitude ranging from 5,000 to 10,000 feet. And according to the recent census, we're over just shy of 300,000. Well, actually, we are just tipping over. I think it's like 320 people. I think that's where we're at right now. And half of our population lives on the reservation, and then the rest of us, like myself, I live and work in Phoenix, I mean out of Phoenix, rather. And many live, they go to college, and then they remain in the cities, like in Phoenix, Albuquerque, New Mexico, Dallas, Texas, Salt Lake City, Utah, L.A., those larger cities, because, you know, we just don't have the jobs available on the reservation. And so, and then we have our reservation is surrounded by pretty significant border towns. And we actually make those border towns thrive because we have no merchandise, no, you know, we can't buy cars on the reservation. There's no, you know, we can't buy, you know, refrigerators or televisions on the reservation. There's no stores there. So we go off reservation, buy all of our, you know, needs for groceries and so on and so forth. So we really contribute to society in that way. And then my, the mine up where my family lives on Black Mesa, I know that we pay a huge amount of tax to the state of Arizona, and so we contribute in those ways, which the rest of the world doesn't see. But we have a three-branch government. We have an executive, we have a president, legislative, and which comprises of 24 council, and then judicial, we have an attorney general. And the Navajo government was formed in 1923, in order to sign mineral leases, because at the time the government, U.S. government, realized that, you know, Navajo was rich with all of this, you know, natural resources. Mm-hmm. So they needed somebody or, you know, some folks to sign these lease agreements. And so since that time we had a chairman, but up to about 1989, then we switched to a three-branch government. We were back in the 1860s. We were rounded up. There was probably the government didn't. I mean, the people didn't really know the Navajo folks because in those times, in that era, they were very nomadic. And then we were in various bands. We didn't have one central leader. There was several. I mean, numerous bands. You know, just moving around. And, you know, one band might be friendly to the settlers and to the Mexicans, so on. But, you know, another band coming along, everybody just kind of, you know, made this, thinking that all Navajos were alike. And so they started, you know, all of these raids and taking Navajos for slaves and vice versa, back and forth. So finally the government got set up and decided to round all the Navajos up, and they took about 5,000 to 8,000 Navajos and marched them to Fort Sumner, New Mexico, along the Rio Grande, which is quite a ways from where our homeland is. And there we were suppressed to, you know, horrific conditions at the fort, and thousands of or hundreds of people died of hunger and sickness, heartache, and abuse by the soldiers as well. and the American food did not agree with our people because we were very, you know, we maintained very healthy diets up till that point, and we've never had to use white flour, sugar, salt, and all that, you know, up until then, coffee, and what was issued at the fort to these folks was cooked the wrong way, so a lot of them died, you know. And then otherwise, you know, they try to hunt for rabbits, mice, and prairie dogs just to survive. And about 2,000 to 3,000 died, you know, during the incarceration. And then this is not to forget the when they were rounded up, marching over, about 1,000, 2,000 or so died as well. You know, these were the ones that the old and the weak, as well as the children who couldn't keep up on the march, were to the fort, were shot dead by Kit Carson and his soldiers. So, you know, this is just very egregious what we had to contend with. And then finally, in 1868, the Civil War general Sherman came out to Fort Sumner and saw the horrific conditions that the Navajo prisoners were being subjected to. And in June, you know, just within the following month, you know, June 1st, 1868, the Treaty of 1868 was signed by 29 Navajo headmen with the U.S. government. And we were fine, our ancestors were finally released and were allowed to return to their native or their original homeland. And the government at the time decided to teach us a good lesson by giving us this, you know, piece of arid land. And they, one of the agreements was that we were supposed to become farmers, no longer raid and no longer bear arms and so on and so forth. And so and they gave us a couple, two heads of sheep and goats, and released the folks back to the homeland. And they probably were chuckling under their breath, saying, you know what, these people will never be able to scratch a living out of this red dirt.
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, nothing is here, and the earth is so barren there. Well, come to find out, uh-huh, in the early 1900s, we have 25% of America's supply of uranium on Navajo Nation. And we have the richest deposits of coal on Navajo Nation. And we have oil, and on the Utah side of Navajo Nation.
Mm.
And then we also used to have a forestry, sawmill. And so the early 1900s, the Navajo folks were probably at their prime. They were so independently, economically, not dependent on the government.
Because
aggressive, yes.
Because of the resources that they had and that the government...
No. We had no idea.
Aha, that wasn't until later.
After 1923 did we find out we have all of this natural resources. But from the 1868 to 1920s, we became so self-sufficient. We have thousands of, you know, flocks, and, you know, these flocks weren't small, of sheep and goats, and people were very wealthy in a sense, you know, that they have all these hundreds of sheep, cattle, horses. And then that was the livelihood of the folk, of our people, of our ancestors at the time. And the Navajo women were weaving rugs. They're famous Navajo, worldwide, well-known Navajo rugs. And the men, we have silversmithing really came from Navajo. They were taught to shoe the Spanish plateros, you know, the horses back in the 1700s. And so the Navajo people were very good with their hands, and they refined the silver, and they started making silver jewelry.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and they taught the rest of their Pueblo neighbors. And so we're very self-sufficient. We had, huge cornfields and vegetable fields, and we had always had a very healthy diet. And so, but then the government came along and decided you people need a council or need a leader. So, you know, one was appointed, and then they formed a tribal government just to sign mineral leases.
Uh-huh.
And that's when, you know, the floodgates were open, and we were just pretty much, you know, at the mercy of the government. And we're supposed to be, all of these activities are supposed to be monitored by U.S. Office of Surface Mining, but they've not done a good job at all. We're still suffering from the all of the there was, I think, U.S. EPA and Superfund identified at least 1,500 uranium mines all over that weren't even monitored by the any agency. There was no oversight by the government. People just went in, started mining, and the Navajo men were never issued protective clothing to go into these mines, and they were never taught the dangers of radioactivity, the mine, and at the end of the or the uranium. At the end of the day, they go home and just be with their families, you know, all the, carrying all this stuff home. And so as a result, we have, you know, hundreds and thousands of people that died from cancer just because, you know, they were mining. And then, of course, they also, you know, some of this, you know, they were also impacted their own family members.
Sure.
And so it's just an ongoing legacy, and we just have not had the proper oversight from these federal agencies. And like with the Peabody mine,
well, I want to get
on Black Mesa. The government's allowing the Office of Surface Mining is allowing them to mine on a temporary permit. Temporary permit alleviates Peabody of any environmental damages, any impacts. They just walk away scot-free. And so there has been a surge of Navajo grassroots movement started to happen in about 15, 20 years ago, and they're getting stronger, and they're getting more in number. And so we're going, and really, you know, these folks have had to be self-taught. They go and, you know, learn about the impacts themselves. And because our government really doesn't look out for us either, our own tribal government, because at one time the royalties that was about two-thirds of the general funds was coming derived from the coal and oil royalties.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore they're not proactive in really addressing these issues. It's the grassroots, it's the people that have to contend with these issues on a daily basis that are saying, hey, you know what, this is not right. You got, you know, so they're out there, they're getting messages out, just like what I'm doing right now.
Wow, quite a history, very fascinating. This is Bert Cohen. We're talking with Elsa Johnson, director of ENA, Solutions, trying to find solutions to a lot of the problems that the Navajo Nation has had thanks to the U.S. government for many years. And I find it fascinating. You were talking earlier about being self-sufficient, being relatively wealthy in terms of, you know, having enough resources and food to get along okay. And here we are, white nation in the 21st century, and guess what? We are not self-sufficient. We are dependent on, you know, resources of other people, of other exploited nations, and we need to learn how to be self-sufficient. And a lack of community, a lack of identity has been a problem for this white nation for a long time, and this is something we have to learn from as well. And oftentimes people talk about, I mean, there's many different ways of generating electricity. One is oil, there's coal, and there's nuclear. And I think we shouldn't call it nuclear power so much as uranium power, because that's what it is. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not without pollution. And I've seen a bit of footage of Indian children sliding down big piles of uranium tailings. It's milled, it's dug out. I don't know exactly the full process, but sliding down the stuff that's like sand, and it's tremendously radioactive. I don't know if this was on the Navajo land, but certainly the exploitation has been, well, just phenomenal, beyond imagination. We've seen this tradition of the coal companies working hand in glove with the government, with the alleged regulators. You know, the regulators tend to be more cheerleaders. And I wonder about, well, specifically coal as well as uranium. The coal mining is on the Navajo Nation area. How has the water been affected, the hydrologic cycle, and the environmental effects in general from the coal burning? Tell us about that.
Mm-hmm. We have, there's three coal mines on Navajo, which, you know, at one time accounted for over $60 million in royalties and taxes to the tribe, which is, you know, 60% of our tribe's total general funds. So that's why, you know, it's almost protected, and it's almost like, you know, they don't really want to hear about our issues. But as far as the water contamination, U.S. EPA, Navajo EPA, and the Superfund project, they have a 5-year project, which is ending this year, 2012. And they're supposed to identify all of these remaining mines that were never, milling sites that were never identified back in the 1950s through the 70s and 80s. The studies show that uranium mining, this haphazard, method of mining, contaminated over 55% of the Navajo land and waterways. And the same way with Peabody mining up on Black Mesa, that's my community, and we have probably the most pristine water source on the south side of, on this side of the Rocky Mountains. It's called the Navajo Aquifer. And this Navajo Aquifer supplies at least, 40 Navajo communities with good potable water. And it's probably one of the best, tasting waters around, and it doesn't really have to be, purified, because it's almost so pure. And 40 Navajo communities, we have 110 communities, they're like little towns on the Navajo reservation, and 40 of them use the in-aquifer. They depend on the in-aquifer. And then all of the Hopi Nation, the Hopi tribe, uses and depends on the in-aquifer. So there's thousands of families that, drink this water, not to mention the schools and all of the other, it's a public drinking source. And Peabody was allowed by the Office of Surface Mining to use this pristine water to slurry coal from on top of Black Mesa, 272 miles to Laughlin, Nevada, to the Mojave Generating Station for over 20 years. And they were using 4,700 acre-feet of pristine water to slurry coal to get coal to that plant in Nevada from Arizona, from the Navajo Nation. And some of these agreements were done when our people weren't well formally educated,
right.
And we were given a lot of promises by Peabody, by Navajo Generating Station, which is just sits about 60 miles west of the mine. And, of course, those promises were never kept. We were promised electricity and running water. And today, about 20,000 Navajo folks still live without running water or electricity. And so going back to the Navajo aquifer, it's been, it's being depleted with all the, because U.S. surface mining allowed them to use it for industrial use.
Hmm.
And this is potable water. I mean, this is the best drinking water and this is the only drinking water for these communities. And they've allowed Peabody to just, wreak havoc on our water supply. And
has this slurry affected the environment of the area? Mixing all that coal.
Oh, definitely, yes. And the slurrying activity, well, it stopped in 2005 because there was an outcry from the local folks. And the same way with the Hopis, they did the same too. Here's what happened, okay? My brother, who used to work out in Illinois, and he would come out and visit, and he was a cowboy, so he would always ride the range, check on the cattle and so on and so forth. And he started noticing these sinkholes forming in the ground, and he was just, he thought maybe, at first he didn't think anything, and then, another time he was out riding, same thing, and then another time these sinkholes were getting longer and longer. So finally he followed one, and one took him like 10 miles long, and he was really just shocked because he told himself, he's making mental notes. And he said, the first time I was out riding, I didn't see this. Now, the next few times it was at this, distance. Now it's like running into the next community. And he started questioning. He started, researching. And what he came to terms was the aquifer wasn't recharging. So, when the aquifer doesn't recharge, it starts to kind of start sinking,
Mm-hmm.
And so after that, he really started looking into it, and then he met this former Hopi chairman. He was their tribal leader, and so the two of them decided to go to their council, go to the government. Respective governments and start telling them there's something wrong here. We need to really start looking into the activities of Peabody, and we need to look at the environmental impacts. Up till then, nobody was talking about environmental impacts. No one was talking about health impacts up till then. And so they really pressed their government, and it took my brother at least 3 years going back and forth to the government. To our tribal leaders, they would throw, they closed the door on him because they didn't want to hear what he had to say, because it meant accountability. It meant, having to look at the health impacts and having to listen to, and not, rather than enjoying this $60 million royalties, So, what he did was he did community education. A lot of these folks do not speak or read English. So he, made his own graphs and boards, and he told them, okay, this is where we're at now. Our aquifer was here, now it's declining. And so, and he's self-taught, hydrologist, okay, you have to be,
Sure.
And so with that, 11 communities said no more using the aquifer, the Navajo aquifer, to slurry the coal to Nevada. So he got on his horse and he rode into the Navajo capital with 11 resolutions and put that before the council. This is the wishes of the people. You cannot ignore this. They're saying no, no. And all the while, at the time, the Interior Secretary was Gail Norton. She was pressing Navajo Nation. Renew the water lease with Peabody.
Mm-hmm.
And Peabody was only paying $2 million for the water lease. And, I mean, they were just getting away scot-free with everything. And so, at any rate, then the Navajo Nation had no choice but to let the water lease in, which it expired December 2005.
Mm-hmm.
Since then, it's not been renewed. So because of there's two mines up on Black Mesa, Black Mesa Mine and Kayenta Mine. So that ended the Black Mesa Mine. Peabody had to shut down Peabody Black Mesa Mine. Black Mesa Mine supplied the coal to Laughlin, and then the Kayenta Mine supplies coal to the Navajo Generating Station, which is about 60, 70 miles north, or west, rather. And so that shut down the Mojave Generating Station in Laughlin. And along with that was Sierra Club, and then some other, I think it was Grand Canyon Trust. There's another nonprofit, environmental agencies. These are outside agencies
mm-hmm.
that were also, you know, have lawsuits against Mojave plant. And so that was the end of that plant. So they are not using our water to slurry any longer. But the thing is, Peabody has at least 150 holding ponds up on the around the mine, and they say, I mean, and then the tribe and then the U.S. Office of Surface Mining just listen to Peabody. Peabody will tell them, oh, you know, we're safe, it'll never leak, but of course it's leaking, and we know so, and the water has not been, you know, we're pressing them. We're pressing our, you know, in court saying Peabody needs to, you know, they need to be made accountable. And it wasn't up until this summer that they finally opened, after almost 40 years of mining. They never shared their public records, public information with anybody. And so it took four Navajo environmental organizations to file a lawsuit against them to finally open their records. I mean, that's what we have to contend with.
Interesting.
Yes, it's contaminated our water sources tremendously.
And there's still the holding facilities up there, which must be a significant threat as well. If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here talking with Elsa Johnson, director of ENA Solutions, humanitarian and environmental justice organizations that she established to help improve the quality of life for rural Navajo elders who lack basic human needs, to bring commerce to Navajo via clean energy. And let's talk about some of these possible solutions. You know, there was that statement you made earlier about people who are downwind ought to be able to participate in the decision-making about that, and obviously have been left out. And tell us about your organization and how specifically it involves Navajo elders, you know, working on these issues in particular.
Yes. Well, I come from a family of environmentalists. My brother has, before environmental advocacy was popular on Navajo Nation, he was one of the very first ones. And he really is an inspiration to me because he's my younger brother. And he is always concerned about seven generations ahead.
Right.
And what do we leave for our children and their grandchildren. And that's the reason why he fought Peabody on the, you know, saving the in aquifer. And then I have a niece who is also has her own organization, Black Mesa Water Coalition, and that's the same thing, is to save our only water source, because we're in the desert, you know.
Sure.
And then we've been experiencing on going on 15 years of annual drought. And here, you know, this mega corporation is just, you know, wasting our only water source. So I said they're the ones that are, you know, basically doing the environmental advocacy. And they tried to, after L.A. decided to pull their, you know, they want to take out their ownership out of Navajo Four Corners Power Plant, which is just on the north side of Navajo. But first of all, let me just iterate that there's five power plants that circle or sit on Navajo Nation. We have the highest rate of asthma, cancers, and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Respiratory diseases is just rampant. Any rate, but we'll get back to that later. So they are on the, you know, advocacy and their public education, and so they, you know, they do that. That's their work. That's on a daily basis. But a few years ago when California was trying to, you know, pull their ownerships out of Navajo Generating Station and also Four Corners Power Plant, they were there meeting with the folks down in California saying, you know, we want to transition, you know, transition these ugly, terrible smokestacks from coal, you know, 100% coal to maybe, you know, transition 20% at a time to solar, you know, something clean, something that's not inhibit the earth or the air or the water and the people. So, with that, I thought, you know, we need to put something in the ground that's a project for people to see what's possible with solar. And so I have a dear friend of mine, Mark Snyder. He's my solar expert. We put together a program. My nonprofit and Mark Snyder Electric put together what evolved was the Plateau Solar Project. And Navajo and a few of the tribes, Southwest tribes, sit on top of the Colorado Plateau. And we designed a system that will not only bring solar electricity, but water and sanitation, because, like I said, 20,000 Navajos still don't have bathrooms. They don't have, you know, running water in their kitchen or electricity. So we decided to do a create a comprehensive solution. And I told him, I said, I grew up living without electricity or running water, so I know what it's like. All we do week in, week out is haul water in these 55-gallon barrels. And this is still going on today. And every winter, fall, we get ready for the winter. We haul, chop wood, haul wood, make sure there's enough wood because people still use stoves to heat their homes.
Sure.
No electricity.
Mm-hmm.
So I said we have to address all of this in one, you know, with one solution. So brought about the creation, invention of EMPIS, which is the Intertopia Multipurpose Utility Structure. And in it has the 16 solar batteries, the inverter, the hot air panel, it'll have the hot air panels and then the hot water heater, 55-gallon water tank, a bathroom, or a compost toilet, and also the solar thermal sink and shower stall. And so it was an 8x20, like a building, really well insulated because, you know, the temperatures are just really extreme up on the Colorado Plateau. You have extreme cold in the winter, extreme heat in the summer. And we saw some of the other installs that were done. We did a good field study, and these batteries were just left in a metal box sitting outside, and these batteries get fried up in a year or two if you do that.
Mm.
So we said we need to really pamper our batteries, pamper every part and piece that and make it, you know, build it to last 25, 30 years rather than 1 year, you know.
Sure.
So that's what we're doing. And what we did was there's a USDA rural development grant, and of course these Navajo folks, the older folks don't read or write, so they're not aware of, they can't read about these opportunities. So we found that they can do home improvements with you know, like a $7,000 grant, or but they have to be deemed no or low income, and so we identified this grant, and then we identified another grant, which is the Renewable Energy Investment Funds, that came from as a result of a lawsuit against one of the other coal fire plants a few miles from Navajo Nation, the Springerville power plant, and I guess there was a $5 million settlement, and then the owners of that plant said, okay, this money's going to only be used for, you know, on tribal lands, and it's supposed to be for renewable energy projects. And so the owners of all these utility companies dictate how these money should be used.
Right.
Well, we put that money together, 75%, and we got 25% from USDA, so we're able to, you know, give two kilowatt solar unit to elders so they can have electricity. Right now they're using kerosene lamps.
Mm.
I know this sounds, you know, it probably sounds surreal to a lot of folks, but there's actually still people living without electricity and running water in America. And then when there's a devastation that happens, you know, a world away, people throw the millions over there, and here we are, you know, we're supplying my coal from Navajo, from on top of Black Mesa on Navajo Nation, supplies all of the Southwest with cheap electricity, and Southern California with cheap electricity, and all of Las Vegas, all those brilliant lights you see in Las Vegas, that's my coal lighting up the entire city. And yet, my people are still living without electricity and running water. It's just, you know, to me, that's just such an injustice. It's an insult to us, to me. And we have all these power plants that have, you know, these KV lines running, crisscrossing our reservation.
Right.
And yet, you'll see a little homestead sitting underneath one of those KV lines, using kerosene lamp, and they have a 55-gallon water barrel sitting outside, you know, to last them for 2 weeks. I mean, it's just travesty to me. It's just appalling. And yet, you know, our leaders here in Arizona, they just are blind to all of this. I mean, I could name some, you know, national, you know, leaders that are just, you know, to me, they're clueless. I don't care how long they have been a senator from Arizona. I'm not going to name, but you know who I'm talking about.
Could it be John McCain?
Yes. You never see him on the reservation. Never see him. And it's because of his political shenanigans that a land was frozen on Navajo land. It's called the former Bennett Freeze.
Uh-huh.
And that land, the Navajo folks could not repair a leaky roof. They could not fix a broken window. They could not do any kind of improvement for 43 years. And it finally was lifted in 2008, and Obama finally okayed it in 2009. So now these folks who have been subjected to probably the most extreme poverty in all of the U.S. Are from that area, and McCain's responsible for it. Right now those folks are in Washington, D.C., trying to say we need a couple more million for housing, because these people are living in, you know, deplorable conditions. But, of course, McCain's saying, oh, no, that's too much.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're still trying to play catch-up. And that's the reason why you see a lot of the tribes resorting to casinos because they just want to, you know, they just want to catch up. That's all.
Well,
you know, using those revenues. So I don't want to go into the casino. I don't know nothing about, I don't want to talk about it.
No, not a good thing.
I'd rather stay on the environmental.
Not a good thing.
We created, I'm sorry, Bert, but we created this solar project.
Right.
And it's on the ground now. We're on the ground. We're doing site work for the utility buildings that are going to house all the parts and pieces and protect these parts and pieces. And so we have 37 elders that were working at the homes of 37. And then now we're finding out that half of them don't have wiring, so we're going to have to rewire, and that's not part of the scope, or they're not allowed at the budget from the USDA, and then also from the RIFE funds do not cover that. And so I'm also doing fundraising, and I'm asking for donations too, and in that respect. I think I know, and I sincerely believe solar electricity is the answer, especially in the Southwest.
Especially
in a place where we have virtually year-round, we have, you know, sun.
It's like a no-brainer, but too often things...
No-brainer, you would think so. I mean, and then you have, here's what's going on, you know, we're demanding that the Navajo Generating Station, Kayenta Mine supplies that generating station with electricity, and then electricity is made, and then, of course, all of that electricity is powers all of Arizona down, you know, Southwest and into Southern California and Las Vegas, and then that power also lifts water from the Colorado River and delivers water to all of these metropolitan areas in Arizona and then the southern farms and then down to Tucson. And then we're still hauling water in 55-gallon barrels, contaminated barrels at that. I mean, it's not, our water transfer is so archaic and unsafe. A lot of people are, you know, have, you know, intestinal problems because of it.
And you talk about the potential of solar and all that stuff.
Yes.
I wonder about, you know, to build expanding electric power lines, making the switch away from these big, you know, central power plants, coal and uranium plants, into solar can cost a heck of a lot of money. I can imagine, you know, there's still that huge demand for electricity in Las Vegas and places like that. What kind of access to the you know, financing might there be? Might there be federal funding? I would think that this would be something that, you know, finance agencies might be interested in. You know, you invest X amount of dollars, you get X amount back. I would think that, you know, for the Navajo to be in the driver's seat might be a good thing. But how possible is this? Where's the financing going to come from?
Well, I think if the federal government mandates a transition, I think, you know, it could be pretty powerful. But, you know, right now, John Boehner and his outfit, they're so anti-renewable energy. And then with what happened, it was Solyndra. I mean, those things are just, the roadblocks. But here in the state, I'm just amazed that our own governor can't even see the potential because, you know, the utility owners are the ones that really play the cards. And like Absolutely. Arizona Public Service, APS, SRP, which is Salt River Project, Tucson Electric, they're the ones that really, I mean, I think utility and elected officials go hand in hand. We're always up against the odds. But we do have a lot of people that are realizing, you know what, yes, it is expensive at the beginning, but then in the long run, you know, we save. And then it's doesn't have any health impediments. It doesn't have any negative influence on the earth and the air. And so there was two studies done in May 2011. One study was APS, which is Arizona Public Service, Informed Perception Project Report. 94% of the people surveyed wanted an increase in the use of solar as a part of the state's energy portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
82% want an increased use of wind power. And they said that getting energy from sources that will never be used up. And that's a quote, you know, from one of the people that was interviewed. And second most important issue was related to renewable energy as well, minimizing pollution, because even in the outside of Navajo Nation, within the Southwest, people are really seeing the impacts of the, you know, respiratory diseases and cancers, you know, brought on by these coal-fired plants. And in this opinion, coal was perceived as the most harmful to the environment.
No,
and coal is the only source in which participants favored a reduction in use. So, you know, solar was ranking, you know, way on top.
Well, let me just ask you about you know, part of the problem, I would think, for the Navajo Nation is losing young people. You know, they want to have a future, of course, and keeping the tradition and the memory, the incredibly important memory of the elders alive. And it seems to me, I'm just thinking that perhaps through this solar project and a brighter mm-hmm. solar future, it can perhaps help work with the elders as well as keep young people, you know, with an economic future in Navajo Nation. Yeah. Tell us about that.
Well, it's you know, it's great. I know it sounds like it's doable. And it's been tried. My niece with the Wahela, she has her organization. They do like a youth summit every summer and try to really get these kids educated and aware of the environment and, you know, the importance of maintaining and fighting for the environment. So I think there's a crop of new folks coming up, which is great. And but it's everything is usually a dead end at the central government, tribal, you know, the president. He doesn't, I mean, there was a survey done, okay, on the impact. Like my brother will tell you that, you know, around our community, there's the closest hospital is about 50 miles away.
Right.
And in a couple years ago, when the school kids were being given the H1N1, 110 school kids were taken to the Tinley Hospital, and only 40 were able to get their shots because the rest of them had respiratory, issues.
Right.
And so, going back to the study, I'm sorry, but I wanted to really also tell you that too. That another study was done last year, Arizona voter polling, and the key findings. This is all about where people get their electricity or power and their everybody, I think it was 82% of those people that were polled or surveyed said, let's go to solar. I mean, you would think that that should speak to our governor. You know, there's two sources done, independent surveys done, and everybody is saying,
let's,
you know, almost 90% saying, let's go to solar. And I want to see that happen. So that's one of the reasons why I do what I do. And in Navajo, I mean, we say hojo.
Yes.
Hojo means, you know, harmony, balance, and also beauty. And a huge part of our philosophy and our way of life is maintaining harmony. And harmony is a driving force in Navajo life. And I think that with, you know, a solar project, the solar power doesn't impact, you know, people. It doesn't impact the air and the land.
It keeps harmony.
I mean, I think it's, harmony.
It's a good word for all of us to learn. Hojo?
You know, yeah. And then we have the sun, you know, that generates that electricity.
Sure.
I mean, why can't we do this? And
oh, we have
I think
to.
it's because of political will.
Yes.
If political will was there, it would be done. But right now, the utility companies are so powerful. I mean,
well,
the lobbyists, you know.
That's the history
of
the far
Peabody,
west.
Peabody's a $10 billion company. And here we are, we're just little grassroots people. It's like fighting a Goliath, but we're not going to give up.
Right. David's, you know? People sympathize with David's, and the David's often win. Let me just ask real quickly, if people want to read more about the ENA Foundation, there must be something on the web you can direct them to?
Yes. Yes. We are at iinasolutions.com,
mm-hmm.
which is enasolutions.com.
All right. Well, hopefully people look at that. And I did want to read one thing from a book I just finished, and I'm going to be interviewing this author soon. This is about the First Nations in Canada. There's a new game in town where First Nations are driving outcomes across the board and trying to achieve a balance between their land, history, the modern economy, and the future. And just one other quote, communalistic, environmentally minded, and female dominated, the people of First Nation will have a very different approach to the global challenges of the 21st century than that of other nations of the continent and the world. And it's already started in Greenland. First Nation is building a series of nation states of its own, giving America's North America's indigenous people a chance to show the rest of the world how they would blend postmodern life with pre-modern folkways. Elsa Thang Johnson, thank you so much. Again, it's enasolutions.com. Thanks very much for being a guest with us today on the Bert Cohen Show.
Thank you, Bert.
And best of luck.
Thank you.
Six nations.